In June 1963, the Cold War had gotten quite warm. That previous October, the United States and the Soviet Union had gone to the brink of nuclear war and the Cuban Missile Crisis, which Arthur Schlesinger called the most dangerous moment in history. And by that year, President Kennedy had increased American personnel in South Vietnam to 16,000, and the Soviets and Americans had tested over 120 nuclear weapons in 1962 alone. And yet, in this tense climate, JFK forged the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty with Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev. Jeffrey Sachs, economist and director of Columbia University's Earth Institute, writes about Kennedy's vision and its lessons for today in his latest book called To Move the World, JFK's Quest for Peace. It's published by Random House, and it brings Jeffrey Sachs back to our show. Hello.
How are you?
Now, 50 years ago today, JFK gave a speech on peace at the American University. Haven't you made it a focal point in your book?
Today is a remarkable anniversary. I think it's the greatest speech by an American president in modern history.
Should we listen to a clip from it?
That would be great.
What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world by American weapons of war. Not the peace of the grave, or the security of the slave. I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living, the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children, not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women, not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time.
That Ted Sorensen sure could write a good speech, but I'm assuming he wrote the words, although JFK probably told him what he wanted in there.
Yes.
Churchill reference also would have come from JFK.
They worked as a close pair in ideas as well as words, and those words are compelling, and just about everything else in this speech was so compelling that it really did, as a speech, not only present ideas, but it actually moved Nikita Khrushchev, as you said, to want to make peace with the U.S.
And you called the year from October 1962 to September 1963 Kennedy's Annus Mirabilis, his miracle year, a phrase in the past that was used for scientific giants like Einstein and Newton. What made it a miracle year?
You know, Kennedy came into office with that dazzling inaugural address, January 1961, with the huge hopes and aspirations for peace, for negotiating with the Soviet Union, for solving great world problems. But the 2 years were very rocky, the first 2 years. Kennedy started out with a terrible blunder, one that shadowed him thereafter, the Bay of Pigs, which was a CIA-inspired, CIA-led debacle to invade Cuba.
Hadn't he started off even earlier with a little saber rattling? Because when he ran for president, he talked about the missile gap, which must have played rather poorly with the Soviet leadership. It did help him win the election, even though it turned out not to be true.
As soon as he came in, his advisors told him, well, Mr. President, there really is no missile gap, something that he perhaps could have known earlier. It's not clear exactly what he knew or what he might have believed, but he did know it early on. He believed that the U.S. should be strong and should negotiate from strength. But things got out of hand. First came
the
Bay of Pigs, and then a very, very rocky, discouraging summit with Nikita Khrushchev in Vienna. And at that summit, Khrushchev upped the stakes dramatically to Kennedy's shock, because Khrushchev said, we're going to sign a peace treaty with East Germany. We're going to end the rights of access of the Western powers to West Berlin. This immediately set in motion more drama, a sense of a new Berlin showdown after the Berlin airlift a dozen years before.
Is this when they built the Berlin Wall?
Well, then, because of this mass exodus, which was accelerating from East Berlin to West Berlin, suddenly in August of 1961, the Berlin Wall went up. In a way, that actually tamped down the immediate crisis. The Soviets were very embarrassed by the exodus. The wall stopped the exodus. Fortunately, Khrushchev did not follow through on his claim that he would make a unilateral treaty and then seal off Berlin. But of course, what he ended up doing was far more dangerous. That was the decision to install nuclear missiles, medium-range nuclear missiles in Cuba. And that, of course, as you noted, brought the world to the very brink of annihilation.
But atmospheric levels of carbon-14, radioactive carbon, were spiking already in the 1960s. Did the American and Soviet governments know about those rising levels?
Well, they did. There was a lot of outcry starting in the 1950s about nuclear testing, a lot of concern about nuclear fallout. From 1958, indeed, till the middle of 1961, both sides abstained from nuclear testing. Then after the Vienna summit, the Soviets resumed, and Kennedy just felt, again, shattered and tricked by that. Neither side was playing straight. This is absolutely the sad point, and events were spiraling out of control. So Khrushchev started again the Soviet tests of absolutely mammoth hydrogen bombs. Then that led the United States to resume its testing. This, of course, scared everybody in the world, but it also meant that this high hope that Kennedy had come into office with, that yes, the U.S. would negotiate from strength, but it really would negotiate and it would reach agreements, everything seemed to be dashed.
Because JFK would not have gone along with the idea that the world was, that the United States was the world's policeman?
Well, he believed, as a senator and as someone who had lived through war himself, and indeed with the near loss of life and his heroic actions in World War II, that there had to be a better way. And his mentor in that actually was Winston Churchill, a person that Kennedy admired from youth throughout his life as the exemplar of the strong leader. Churchill, who we remember, of course, as standing up to Hitler, also at the end of World War II said, we need to find a path to peace with the Soviet Union.
And but he Kennedy, also advocated foreign intervention, didn't he?
Winston Churchill?
Yeah.
He definitely advocated the continuation of the British Empire, that's for sure.
Well, he said of the Bolshevik Revolution that it must be strangled in its cradle.
Churchill had a long life and a very vigorous one, and he was a hardliner in many things. And with respect to the Soviet Union, though, after all, he was the one who made the whole term the Iron Curtain, the term that it became. He said we should not simply go on with the idea that there's no better path than a mutual buildup of arms. Kennedy agreed with that, wanted that. But then when the Cuban Missile Crisis broke in the fall of 1962, not only did those hopes seem to have vanished, but even the survival of the world suddenly was at stake.
What role did the Cuban Missile Crisis play in pushing the limited test ban treaty? Had the treaty already been worked on at this point?
There had been negotiations, one could say, even for a decade, over many aspects of arms control. None of those negotiations had accomplished the purpose of reaching any kind of agreement on any front, including a test ban. Kennedy thought coming into office that a test ban would be the most likely treaty to be within quick reach. But as events deteriorated, as testing on both sides started again, as hardliners on both sides pointed to the other side to say, you see, there's no one that one can trust. It seemed increasingly out of reach. Of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis changed everything, though, for Kennedy and for Khrushchev. This was so close to the utter end of everything for both sides, the near self-destruction of the entire planet, that it's almost impossible to imagine that a leader would not have been fundamentally touched by this. And Khrushchev at one point was asked, were you scared? He said, are you crazy? Of course I was terrified. Are you kidding? How you couldn't be a human being and be rational and not have been terrified at what happened.
Well, Eisenhower Secretary of State John Foster Dulles talked about brinksmanship, but this was the ultimate in brinksmanship. It actually brought us to the brink, and that had to scare everybody. So that was an incentive for both sides to come up with some treaty?
I think not only were they at the brink, but both sides realized how weak the command and control systems were, how possible it was that accidents would take place, planes that flew missions that they weren't supposed to fly, pilots that went off course, the fact that field level commanders would have access to the nuclear trigger. This was terrifying, I think, to both sides. They realized how close they came not only to war, but actually to losing control of the events that could have led to war. So after October, Kennedy and Khrushchev clearly took a deep breath. They corresponded privately with each other. They said they had to make a renewed effort towards peace. And Kennedy thought long and hard about this, and early in 1963 decided that he would make a major initiative. In this, UK Prime Minister Macmillan played an important role also encouraging Kennedy to do this. I think that at a human level as well as a level of major ally was a great encouragement to Kennedy. In the early months of 1963, in a number of ways, Kennedy was clearly mulling what to do. It was not easy to make a peace initiative in the height of the Cold War. I like to say to Americans today, it would be as if President Obama came forward with a major initiative towards Iran, for example. You can imagine the screaming. You're an appeaser. You're giving up. You're surrendering. You're a fool. You're trusting a counterpart that can't be trusted. And Kennedy's genius, and it is genius in this period, was to help Americans to understand that it was possible, even with this seeming mortal enemy, to find an arrangement in which both sides could be safer.
My guest is Jeffrey D. Sachs, who is an economist, director of Columbia University's Earth Institute. He is also a syndicated newspaper columnist and the author of many books, including a few bestsellers. His latest is To Move the World, JFK's Quest for Peace. It is published by Random House. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Jeffrey D. Sachs, whose latest book is To Move the World, JFK's Quest for Peace. It is published by Random House. You write that Kennedy recognized that the arms race was a prisoner's dilemma. What's a prisoner's dilemma?
Prisoner's dilemma means that you realize that there is scope for cooperation, but you fear that if you play cooperatively, say you agree to disarm or to stop testing, that the other side's going to cheat on you. And therefore, both sides looking at the situation, even though they know there may be gains to cooperation, end up cheating in a way against their own interest, because they don't have enough trust with the counterpart to actually carry through on the cooperation.
And in your appendices, you include the entire speech that we opened up talking about June 1963. He spoke of peace as the rational end of rational men. But rational people can steer themselves to bad ends and all, for all kinds of reasons. So that culture of fear contributed to tensions between the Americans. We didn't believe, in fact, until Ronald Reagan came along and said, verify We were constantly suspicious.
Yes. Well, the idea that Kennedy had to get across on June 10, 1963, was that peace is possible. And that's why the most remarkable aspect of this speech is not a list of dictates to the Soviet Union, not a laundry list of all the things that the other side has to do, but rather with a call to Americans to reexamine our own attitudes towards peace, because, as he says, our own attitudes are as important towards as theirs. And what he goes on to say is that too many Americans think that peace is impossible, and he convinces them the Soviet Union has the same interest in peace that we do. And in fact, there's lots of virtue on the other side, but most fundamentally, they're human beings. Human beings on both sides have a reason to cooperate, especially in the nuclear age.
Had the concept of mutually assured destruction already been posited at this point?
It was very much the doctrine of the 1950s. The idea of mutually assured destruction, that there would be a stable balance of terror, was one that Kennedy properly never accepted. There is nothing stable about both sides pointing missiles at each other, primed to fire when accidents, misunderstandings, provocations, threats, bluffs could end up in disaster. So Kennedy did not believe, I certainly do not believe either, in a stable mutual balance of terror. And that's why he said we have to pull back from the brink.
Were the United States and the Soviet Union still the only two nuclear powers at this point?
At that point, there were four, because the UK had become a nuclear power in 1952, France in 1960. China was on the verge. It would gain its nuclear weapons in 1964. Kennedy was extremely frightened by the fact that the best analysis suggested that there could be 15 or 20 or even 25 nuclear powers by the end of the 1970s. And he regarded this as utterly, completely unmanageable. So one of the goals of the Test Ban Treaty was indeed to be a stepping stone to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. That's what happened. Kennedy called it. He said, we'll start with the Test Ban Treaty. It's closest in reach, but it will have to be followed by a non-proliferation treaty. The Test Ban Treaty came in 1963, and the non-proliferation treaty came in 1968.
A few months back, your colleague at Columbia, the political scientist Ira Katznelson, was a guest on our show to discuss his book, Fear Itself, and he looked extensively at the impact of Southern Democrats on American politics. What was the domestic political climate like in 1963? McCarthy was no longer a force.
Kennedy believed going into this year that he had to make an attempt at peace, but he was doubtful that he could actually pass a treaty through the Senate. He faced a Republican opposition, and he faced opposition from Southern Democrats, and he faced a mood in the United States, perhaps not a surprising mood given the Cuban Missile Crisis, that peace would be impossible. So Kennedy wasn't just bluffing or trying to spur his closest aides by telling them that this was going to be an extraordinarily tough treaty to get through. This was going to require a massive amount of public education and awareness. And one of the most magnificent parts of this year is the fact that not only did Kennedy have the vision to find a path to peace, not only did he have these magnificent words, which are as beautiful as any president has spoken in modern times, but he was a ward politician also. He was voting, counting votes. He needed two-thirds votes. He didn't care about the high concepts. He wanted a treaty, and that meant that it had to pass the U.S. Senate.
Well, it's come out that Khrushchev thought that he was rather inexperienced, wet behind the ears, and treated him as such. Did Khrushchev come to respect him a bit more? Didn't the Bay of Pigs actually make the situation worse, and then the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Well, that absolutely is key, that in the first year, Not only was the Bay of Pigs it was a blunder, and also Khrushchev was baldly lied to by Kennedy. After the debacle, Kennedy said, "Oh, it's not us, it's not us." And Khrushchev wrote back, "Are you kidding? Of course it's you. Don't even say such things." This was a year after Eisenhower had baldly lied to Khrushchev about the U-2 spy plane, which the Soviets had shot down, and unbeknownst to the Americans, had actually captured live Gary Powers, the pilot. So Khrushchev felt that two times in a row he had been directly lied to by an American president, and he went into the Vienna summit to teach Kennedy a lesson. He was going to be tough. He was going to push him around. And the Cuban Missile Crisis was another example where Khrushchev, not wanting to go to war, but wanting to put to be in the U.S. face, to show the U.S. some of it, what he regarded as its own medicine. Of course, it was a terrible miscalculation, reckless on Khrushchev's part, and Khrushchev realized as well. By early 1963, the two leaders had been carrying on a private, secret correspondence. They had written to each other by then dozens of times. This, in my view, changed a tremendous amount. They came to respect each other. Kennedy famously said that Khrushchev occupies essentially the same role he does, boxed in by his own hardliners. Khrushchev felt that Kennedy was being pushed by the military, which he was, pushed by the CIA and others, and Khrushchev also was extremely careful not to push too hard. At one point,
well, he had his own military pushing him.
He both had the military pushing very hard. By this time, of course, another major fact very relevant for us today is that Kennedy had come to believe that he was just getting miserable, miserable advice from the CIA and from the military.
And although the Soviet Union was a great military power, the United States was by far the world's greatest economic power. And anyone who went to the Soviet Union at that time could see that the system wasn't working very well. It almost seemed to be doomed to fail unless some major reforms were created. So did Kennedy actually believe that communism posed a serious threat to the United States?
Well, I think they did. The times were different. This was the early 1960s. Sputnik had gone up. The Russians were ahead in space technology for several years. This was tremendously frightening. And whether one would count as being ahead or not, and certainly in the nuclear arsenal, the U.S. was way ahead. It was frightening. This was a frightening period, and the Soviet Union certainly did not seem like a pushover, and was no pushover in military terms. Within Europe, the conventional forces, of course, were all in the Soviet balance, and this was very much a complicating factor because the U.S. strategy was to resist a conventional attack by the Soviet Union in Europe with a nuclear attack. And as the Soviet nuclear arsenal increased, that strategy seemed more and more problematic.
Rachel Carson's Silent Spring was published in 1962. Despite successes like the Montreal Protocol to protect the ozone layer, critical environmental problems like climate change and loss of biodiversity are worse today. Are these or other problems that are they particularly resistant to solution?
Kennedy had what I regard as the most beautiful words of the whole speech when he said, "For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortal."
And he said our problems are man-made and therefore can be solved by man. But
yes,
that doesn't seem to be working.
And when you think about it, all breathe the same air. The problem with our air today is mainly that the carbon dioxide has risen so dramatically. We had a new report today about how fast it rose last year, that our climate is being transformed dangerously, and we do not have a global understanding. Yes, our problems are man-made. Therefore, they can be solved by man. That is Kennedy's core message. He was right at the time of the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, and I think the words are applicable today.
We don't have much time left, but I was wondering if the threat of nuclear annihilation was the greatest threat in 1963. What do you think the greatest threats are now?
I think the greatest threat continues to be learning to live together on this extraordinarily crowded planet where people don't necessarily like each other and where the levels of distrust are so high. We still face nuclear risks, obviously, but now we also face these massive environmental risks that so far we have not been able to get our hands on. And unfortunately, I believe President Obama is far too congenial with the intelligence agencies and far too too much giving in to calls by the CIA and the NSA and others for military approaches to problems that require political approaches. Kennedy's insight was we could not solve our problems through military approaches. We need a different approach
of course,
here today.
Kennedy and Khrushchev carried out much of their negotiations secretly, and many details remain totally secret for decades. Today, that would be impossible with WikiLeaks and the speed of international communication. The latest thing, this the NSA programs, the PRISM and the other one. So, what did it help him that he was working in a different kind of environment?
Well, maybe it was a little bit simpler, but I think we draw a lot of lessons. Don't trust the so-called intelligence agencies to make peace. They may be, well, they're not even good at war, I would say, but they're not good at finding the solutions. For that, we need political leadership.
Jeffrey Sachs will be in conversation with Gillian Sorensen at the 92nd Street Y Tribeca tonight at 7:30 p.m. That's at 200 Hudson Street. For more information, go to our show page at WNYC.org.